King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide, and set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. He then summoned the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officers to come to the dedication of the image he had set up. So the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials assembled for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and they stood before it. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "Nations and peoples of every language, this is what you are commanded to do. As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace." Therefore, as soon as they heard the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, and all kinds of music, all the nations and peoples of every language fell down and worshipped the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. At this time, some astrologers came forward and denounced the Jews. They said to King Nebuchadnezzar, "May the king live forever. Your majesty has issued a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music must fall down and worship the image of gold, and that whoever does not fall down and worship will be thrown into a blazing furnace. But there are some Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Sarak, Meshach, and Abednego, who pay no attention to you, your majesty. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold you have set up." Furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Sadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king, and Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, Sadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold I have set up? Now when you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, if you are ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand?" Sadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to him, "King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar was furious with Sadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and his attitude towards them changed. He ordered the furnace to be heated 7 times hotter than usual and commanded some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie up Sadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them into the blazing furnace. So these men, wearing their robes, trousers, turbans, and other clothes, were bound and thrown into the blazing furnace. The king's command was so urgent and the furnace was so hot that the flames of the fire killed the soldiers who took up Sadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and these 3 men, firmly tied, fell into the blazing furnace.
Do keep that passage open, and let's have a look at that now together. Now, I wonder if you'd call yourself a Christian, whether you've ever stood out because you're a Christian. Maybe you've stood out socially because you've chosen not to watch a certain film or TV series that everyone else is obsessing over, or chosen not to swear or not to get drunk because that's not right for a Christian to do. And because of these choices, you feel uncomfortable, exposed. Your friends have rolled their eyes and muttered about the boring people in the God squad. Or maybe you've stood out at work because of the choices that you've made, because of things you haven't chosen to do. As many of you will know, I was an estate agent in a previous life, littered with opportunities to better myself, but not in keeping with the Christian principles of honesty, integrity, openness. And those choices are something that people at work, at university, people face every day, making the right choices.
And for many people, standing out for Christian beliefs can be costly. Christians may fall in other people's estimations. Others won't be promoted. Some will face sanctions. Some will even lose their jobs. And maybe you've been on the receiving end of that. Or maybe you wouldn't call yourself a Christian. Maybe you'd say, well, I get that, but why do you have to take it so seriously? Why can't you just get over it? And yet, standing out, being accused of taking our faith too far, shouldn't surprise us as Christians. I was reading these words recently from Luke's Gospel. Jesus says, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross daily and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will save it. Jesus is talking to some crowds that are following him, and he's explaining what it means to be his disciple, and it's going to mean picking up your cross. And back then, picking up your cross meant that you were condemned to die in the most shameful way possible. It's not a great sell, is it? And yet that's what Jesus tells us being a disciple is like. It means going to mean denying ourselves, making costly choices in order to follow Jesus. It might sound like a terrible deal, but listen to the reward that Jesus offers. Though we will lose our lives now, we'll actually save it. By becoming citizens of heaven, honored children of God. And it's that glory that we receive in part now, but fully in the age to come, that makes standing firm for Jesus worth it. And that's what we see in Daniel chapter 3 as well. Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, well, they stand firm for God, which looks not just incredibly foolish, but frankly terminal as a decision. But they believe that God rules and that his kingdom lasts forever. And so choosing him is the best thing they can do, the wisest way to live, regardless of what comes. And so for them, well, their faith can't be taken too far because it's far too precious. So let's look again at Daniel chapter 3, page 886, if you've closed it in the church Bibles. And the first thing we see is that every society worships something. Let me read verse 1 again. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide, and set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. King Nebuchadnezzar built an enormous statue, probably as tall as the church building here, which is impressive, although actually not necessarily that remarkable at the time. There's other descriptions of statues of this sort of size and scale in the Bible. Archaeologists have found similar statues from the era and the region. The important thing is what it's for. Because this isn't a statue of the king to say, hooray, he's great. This is a statue to be worshipped. And so Nebuchadnezzar gathers all his political leaders, and you see that in verses 2 and 3, and the king's herald gives them an order, verses 4 to 6, which you can boil down very simply. When you hear the music play, bow down and worship this statue, or else. And unsurprisingly, when faced with such a blunt way of saying, you get verse 7. And as soon as they heard the sound of the horn, the flute, the zither, the lyre, the harp, and all kinds of music, all the nations and peoples of every language fell down and worshipped the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Nebuchadnezzar's trying to do something, I guess, maybe to sort of unite his nation. You see the mention there of all the peoples and nations of every language. He rules over an empire of many different nations and languages. He's saying, no, this is something we're all going to do together. Maybe it's for unity, or maybe it's because it's his God that they think that they should be worshipping. But all of this feels a bit unfamiliar, doesn't it? So, you know, can I take a quick poll? Please raise your hand if a reigning monarch has recently asked you to bow down to their statue on pain of death. Anyone? No? Yeah, no, it feels unfamiliar, doesn't it? There's not a lot of compulsory statue worship going on. But the thing is, every society worships something. We just show it in different ways. If we were ancient Romans, we might have set up a statue to the Roman goddess Fortuna, the goddess of fortune, the goddess of success. Now, we don't do that today, but we do still sacrifice our time, our effort, our health, in some cases even our family and our friends, in order to be a success, to make it, because that's what our society believes the god of success demands. We might not have an image of a goddess who is the perfect figure that we aspire to, but we also worship image. Maybe the pristine physical image of the perfect gym body, or maybe the image of the perfect family, or the perfect home, the perfect relationship. And for many of us, this need to look perfect, well, it can be really crushing, can't it? Because the sacrifice that god or goddess demands, well, it's too high. And we're weighted down by this burden. We may not build statues anymore, but our gods are revealed when they're threatened. Because people are quick to jump to their god's defense. Just look at the response to those in public life who hold traditional views on gender and relationships. Whether they hold this because of their religious conviction, as in the Scottish politician Kate Forbes, or because of philosophical stances like J.K. Rowling or Maya Forstarter. Not agreeing with the dominant social view of our day leads to people being hounded on social media and in the press. And one of the reasons for this strong reaction, I'd argue, is because this is something our society worships. Now, the most recent census told us that the UK is officially a majority non-religious country. More people than not ticked the "I have no religion" box. But I'd argue that the reality is the opposite. We're all still worshipping. It's just not an official religion. And this is a problem because as Christians, we're already signed up to worship something else. We worship the Lord God. And so there will always come a point where our faith and the faith of the world around us comes into conflict. Just as there was for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And this is the second thing we see from Daniel chapter 3. And it's that standing up for God is costly. Nebuchadnezzar has commanded the worship of his statue on pain of death. But some of his astrologers have noticed that there's a group of people who aren't doing as they're told, the Jews, God's people. And so they denounce them for failing to comply, especially Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, presumably because they're particularly visible. They are very senior court officials. And so they're summoned before an angry king who gives them one more chance. Look at verse 15 with me, bottom of the second column first column on page 887. He tells them, "Now when you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, if you're ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you will be immediately thrown into the blazing furnace. Then what god will be able to rescue you from my hand?" It's pretty chilling, isn't it? He's the one with all the power. Who can stop a king? Now, we may not be being threatened by kings, but I guess many of us recognize that same pressure. It could be the words of a boss, or a partner, or a friend. Our teammates, do this, you'll suffer. Maybe not thrown into a blazing furnace, but you'll be ostracized, passed over, left alone. And in that moment, we feel weak, we feel alone. God seems a very long way away, and very small. But look at verse 16. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to him, King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves to you before this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve you or gods or worship the image of gold you've set up. They take a stand. They're not rude. They don't fight. But they are firm. And they do this because the king is not their highest authority. They answer to someone greater. They're more concerned with what God thinks of their actions than they are of what the king thinks. Because their God is more than able to save them from any earthly power should he choose to do so. And verse 18 explains why. It's a link back to the first two of the Ten Commandments. They won't bow down to the statue because if you look at Exodus 20, it explicitly tells them to not worship other gods and to not worship idols. They make their choice, but they suffer the consequences as a result. And I was struck again as Euro was reading it for us, that not only is the furnace hotter, but they're tied up by the strongest men in the army. There is no escape. And slightly unceremoniously, they fall into a blazing furnace to meet their fate. And while it's unlikely that we're to be thrown in a blazing furnace because of our faith, there are plenty of pressures for Christians to conform, just like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego experienced. A couple of years ago, a guy called Andrew Thorburn was appointed as the CEO of Essendon Football Club. It's a professional Australian rules football club just on the outskirts of Melbourne. By all accounts, it was his dream job. It was his childhood club, and a job he was more than qualified for. His previous role to this was being CEO of the National Australia Bank, one of the largest banks in the world. More than qualified. But he lasted one day in the role. Now, this wasn't because of some grievous crime he'd committed, some foolish decision he'd made, some public statement or whatever. No, he was forced out because he was also a member of his church council, a church that taught the Bible clearly and faithfully. And that meant, amongst other things, holding to a traditional church teachings on sex and marriage. And that meant, in the eyes of many, that he had to go. He wasn't rude or obnoxious about his faith, but his faith and his role in church meant that he lost his dream job after one day. And I guess some of us might be thinking at this point, well, if that's his dream job, why would you not just give up the church role? Go to a less controversial church? Why do you have to make your faith such a big deal? Why are you taking it too far? But remember Jesus' warning from Luke 9. Whoever wants to save their life will lose it. And these choices represent more than a single action in a single place and time. They say things to our hearts and to our minds. If we don't stand up for God, well, then maybe we're telling ourselves that maybe God doesn't quite matter that much, that his teachings weren't sort of lasting things to be obeyed, or that Jesus isn't really able to save. And as we tell ourselves that it doesn't matter this time, well, it's very easy for us to start to drift. Sure, we'll get to keep the job we want or the position in society that we value now, but the risk is that we lose our life in the end. And not only that, it communicates to others around us that God is no different from anything else. that he's just an optional extra we can sort of bolt on to the side of our lives. We can take and leave. But Christianity becomes just another social club. When Andrew Thorburn left his post, someone wrote about him, "Andrew made the correct decision for himself and the football club. But I did not expect him to choose the church." It seems strange to the world around us, but not when we think of what's at stake. But I wonder, when we have to choose between standing firm for God or going a different way, what will people say about us and the choices we make? Will it say that we trust in Jesus, or will it say that we're no different from anyone else? Will we stand firm, even when it's costly? I know it looks like standing up for God has cost Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego everything. But the surprising thing about Daniel 3 is that the story doesn't finish there. Standing up for God is costly, but wonderfully, God saves. Let's read on. Verse 24. "Then King Nebuchadnezzar leapt to his feet in amazement and asked his advisors, 'Weren't there three men that we tied up and threw into the fire?' They replied, 'Certainly, Your Majesty.' He said, 'Look, I see four men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed, and the fourth looks like a son of the gods.' Nebuchadnezzar then approached the opening of the blazing furnace and shouted, 'Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out, come here.' So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire. And the satraps, prefects, governors, and royal advisors crowded round them. And they saw that the fire had not harmed their bodies, nor was a hair of their head singed. Their robes were not scorched, and there was no smell of fire on them." Now, there's two surprising things we need to recognize here. The first one is obvious. They're not dead. They were thrown into a blazing furnace seven times hotter than the previous time, and they are not dead. Back in verse 15, the king had said, "What God can save you from me?" And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said, "Ours." And they were right, and the king was wrong. God rules. Not the king, not any other god. And if he decides to save, he saves. And notice that it's a complete rescue. They're completely unharmed. Even if you look back in the start of the story, they are thrown in all the things that really burn very well. They don't even smell of smoke. You know that sensation where you've been sat next to the barbecue or a fire pit or bonfire or whatever, and however hard you try, you come in smelling of smoke. But not Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It's as if they've never been near a fire, let alone in the middle of one. And the second surprising thing is, back on the previous page, verse 25. There's someone else in the fire with them. Now, some people will argue that this is Jesus appearing in the Old Testament. I'm personally not persuaded, not convinced. I think it's more likely to be an angel, as the king himself says in verse 28. But whoever it is, it's making a point. This is God doing the rescuing, just so that we're all clear. And the effect it has on Nebuchadnezzar is striking. I'm going to read from verse 28. "Then Nebuchadnezzar said, 'Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own gods. Therefore, I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be cut into pieces, and their houses be turned into piles of rubble. For no other god can save in this way.' Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon." The king sees the power of God displayed, and he respects this, and those who follow this God. I don't think the king's converted. We'll maybe see a bit more of that next week. But he's willing to give them sweeping protections. and to bless Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego with promotions in the court, because God has shown that he can save. Now, Daniel chapter 3 is not a story in isolation. It's written to a people in exile, people far away from home, who feel a long way from God, and feeling under pressure to blend in. But God saves. He saves in a dramatic way that would have been just the most incredible encouragement to those people, to those exiles stuck in a faraway country waiting for God to rescue them. You know, picture the conversations above the amongst those exiles. You know, someone comes up to somebody else and goes, "Did you hear what happened? God saved them." Just think about how encouraging that would have been. And God is still the same God today. And actually, we have even more reason to know that he is a God who saves. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were rescued through fire, but Jesus was brought back to life from the dead, having gone through death itself and defeating its power. It was an even greater rescue that didn't just win us respect and status in an earthly kingdom, but it brings those who trust in him a certain place in an everlasting kingdom. A place that will never perish or spoil or fade away. That, as we saw last week, will never be given to anybody else. God's display of resurrection power on Easter Day shows us even more clearly that God rules and his kingdom lasts forever, because not even death can stop it. We can say even more confidently that God can save. And that equips people to live for him. That frees them up to make that costly decision. Now, I have a friend called Taras, and Taras is from Belarus in Eastern Europe. Sadly, Europe's last dictatorship. And he's a pastor. But Taras no longer lives in Belarus. He can't live there anymore because it's too dangerous for him. His outspoken faith and his refusal to bow down to the government authorities means that he and his wife and his kids have had to leave their home, leave their family, leave their friends, leave their church, and now live in a different country. Preaching Jesus was a costly choice right now, but he's still preaching to this day because God has saved him, and he's looking forward to the day when Jesus returns and he will inherit that eternal kingdom. Now, sadly, if we follow Jesus, at some point we're all going to have to choose whether to stand firm in our faith or not. Maybe not in front of kings or in a story that's going to get splashed over the front pages of the newspaper. But we'll all have a moment where our Christian faith calls us to be different. And in that moment, I guess many of us will want to have the courage to stand firm. But if you're anything like me, you'll worry that maybe your faith isn't strong enough, that we won't be brave enough to make that decision. And if that's you, then you're not alone. I feel that too, as do lots of other people. But there is help for us here in this passage in front of us. Look at verse 16 to 18 again, page 887. King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. Verse 17, the God we serve is able to deliver us. Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego were more concerned about living for God than living for the king. They desire God more. And I think that's the key to making those brave decisions. Desire God more. They knew that God could save if he wanted to, but the most important thing was to live for him here and now. And actually, this same theme is picked up in the New Testament, in the letter to the Hebrews. The writer says this, "For the joy that was set before Jesus, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For Jesus, knowing that he was going to rejoin God in heaven, meant that he could face crucifixion. And as shocking as it sounds, it was better to stay faithful to God than to avoid the challenge that lay ahead of him. He desired God more. And Hebrews uses this as an example for us in verse 3. Consider him. Think about him who endured such opposition from sinners so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. So if we want to have the courage to choose God in that moment, we need to want God more. We need to understand the sure promises of God and why they're worth giving up other things for. Look ahead, look at that joy. We need to fix our eyes on the hope that lies before us. So, friends, let's be reminding ourselves, let's be reminding each other daily, weekly, hourly, that God rules and that his kingdom lasts forever and that our part in it is worth it. And as we rejoice in that, as we remember all that Jesus has done for us, as we remember God's power to save, not just from fire, but even from death itself, well, that'll help us to stand firm, to not lose heart, even when it's costly.